Hello, everybody, and welcome. Welcome, libertarians, conservatives, anarchists, anyone else, and old guys with a cannon in their front yard. This is Jonesing for Liberty, and I'm your host, Rod Jones. So, first off, before we get into the meat of the podcast and what it's about and what I'm going to be talking about in today's show, I'd just like to say this podcast is a project of bipartisan media. I happen to manage the organization mostly. I'm the producer of the main program of bipartisan media, which is the Bipartisan Podcast. That's probably how most of you currently listening know me. And, and yeah, you should email us at bipartisanpodcast@gmail.com. That's bipartisanpodcast@gmail.com. And go to our website, which is until we resolve some minor technical difficulties with our domain. Our website is currently at sites.google.com/view/BP Media. That's sites.google.com/view/BP Media. So, again, thank you everyone who's listening and to everyone who will be listening after the show through our archive that will be available through Anchor and 11 other platforms. Time to tell you what this show's all about. So, as you can see, you can go to the website I just mentioned, sites.google.com/view/BP Media. We have a lot of good things there. We have our home, which is about the whole organization, job openings, which we really need. We don't just need your support. We need you to help us, especially in the production side of things. Since it's pretty much just myself right now, so please consider that. And other than that, you can, under our shows tab, you can see our schedule, which is currently out of date, but I'm going to fix that soon. And, of course, the page for Jonesing for Liberty. So, this show, it's a laid-back libertarian talk show hosted by myself. I'll be talking about major events of the week in a libertarian perspective, as well as lesser-known events that impact you and the libertarian cause. It'll be a mix of comedy, news, and commentary. And occasionally I'll have on a guest, whether it's a person of the same mind as myself, or someone who wishes for a respectful debate on current events. Now, I'm looking forward to that. Hopefully we'll get that going in the next few episodes. So, until then, we have some great stuff lined up for you today. Some great stuff. And, if the logo that you can see now, if you're watching live on Twitch, if the logo that you see now, made by Sam Porter, our wonderful guy at Bipartisan Media, who also works for the Student Post, helps out with graphical design and stuff like that, really great guy, really appreciate the work he's done for us. Anyhow, if this is a beautiful logo is any indication, it looks like we're going to have a great show. So let's get right into today's news. First thing I want to talk about is Joe Biden. He has unofficially announced his campaign, and we're going to kind of look at what that means for the Democratic Party and for the rest of the country. So, basically, based on what I know, Biden is the best shot that the Democrats have of beating Trump in this next election, because let's face it, the other competitors for the Democratic Party nomination, while they do really, I would say, embody the spirit of the modern Democratic Party and really manage to whip up a lot of support, they are not going to be able to appeal to many moderates. And anyone in the middle who's thinking about, oh, I don't know, to want to vote for Trump, but then again, you know, look at these people over here. They're not going to be convinced by people like Kamala Harris or Beto O'Rourke, because unless they are more Democrat-leaning than Republican-leaning, if they're in the middle, that's just not going to be who they're going to vote for. So, in my opinion, Biden stands the best chance of getting the I don't know if he stands the best chance of getting the nomination, per se. He doesn't seem to have a lot of support in the party, but he's their best shot at beating Trump, in my opinion. And that's that's kind of why it's interesting to see how little support he has in the party, because they view him, he's the old guy, he's the uncool version of Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is an old guy, but the Democratic Party puts up with, I wouldn't say they put up with him anymore, but voters put up with him because they like what he's talking about. But Biden, on the other hand, doesn't have that cool factor that Bernie Sanders, I would say, does, if you can call him cool, which I personally, that's probably the wrong word to describe it. But Biden really is, he's the moderate guy, which I find is kind of a bit scary, considering that he's not moderate at all. He, by any measure, a few years ago, he would have been a pretty mainstream Democrat. But now he's more to the middle of the party. You know, he's more moderate than a lot of his counterparts, because really he's just not embracing the whole socialist ideal that the new party seems to stand for. And he's not as radical in his ideas. So that's probably why he stands the best chance at winning against Trump, if he is the Democrat Party nominee, because he does appeal to that middle vote, which you're not going to see in many other Democrats that are running for the nomination. Moving on to our next story, let's talk about Netanyahu. What really happened there? I mean, because most of you probably haven't heard of this, and if you have, you know, there's not a lot of details. It's not really circulating as much in the news right now. But this information I'm getting from is from the Associated Press. So, according to the Associated Press, just over a month before elections, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is looking vulnerable, according to the Associated Press. Of course, this is mainly due to the announcement on Thursday by Israel's Attorney General that Netanyahu faces indictment on corruption charges in the coming months. However, according to the same article by the Associated Press, he still stands a good chance at getting reelected. So what are these corruption charges? It's interesting because there's not a lot of information on this, but according to this Associated Press article, one of the major charges is that Netanyahu allegedly accepted some $300,000 worth of champagne and cigars as gifts from billionaire friends. However, this puts him in a bad light for his, that alone probably puts him in a bad light with a lot of people, but it's not actually a crime. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out in Israel. You know, is Netanyahu actually going to be tried for this and other similar things? Because they're not technically a crime, as far as I know, even in Israel. However, there's some other charges that have not been made public, so it's going to be hard. It's going to be interesting to see what comes about this. But bottom line is, even according to the Associated Press, excuse me, man, kind of something in my throat today. Anyhow, even according to the Associated Press, it doesn't look likely that this is going to affect the election outcome. So, moving on to our next story, Trudeau. So today, you know, for some reason this week, there's just been a lot of random, there's just been a lot of corruption in the headlines. And whether you choose to believe it or not, that's your prerogative. But the point is, the news has been covering a lot of corruption. You know, we have Cohen and Trump, which I'll be talking about later, because if I don't, apparently I won't be considered a news podcast, because that's what literally everyone else is focusing on. Then we have Trudeau, who I'm about to talk about in a second. We have Netanyahu. So it's really interesting to see this development this week. That's what the media is focusing on. However, something most media outlets are not focusing on is Trudeau. So back to him. It's really interesting, you know, just to see, because let's face it, we have to realize that there is bias in the media. And I don't think that the story is getting enough coverage, because it seems like, for instance, one of my, someone that I've worked with for a while at the Student Post, and we've had on the Bipartisan Podcast, Yassine Al-Sheikh, We were talking on Twitter about various things. I post a lot on Twitter. If you want to follow me, I'm at Darodster. That's at Darodster. Darodster. Really just, I'm a very political person, in case you haven't figured it out already. So I'm on there a lot. anyhow, so you've seen, responded to, I retweeted this Canadian guy's tweet. Apparently, I did some research on him. I'm about to quote him in a second here, but his name is Ezra Levant, and he is the editor-in-chief of the Rebel Media, which appears to be a Canadian conservative media organization. So anyhow, I quoted a tweet about him, about Trudeau, and talking about why no one else is talking about Trudeau. It doesn't seem to be very widely covered in media this week. And Yassine made a good point. He said that, you know, I mean, this is proof, you know, people can get along whether even if we have differing political views. And he was talking about how, yes, you know, this is important, too. We need to prosecute corruption in all countries. Of course, he's someone who I know is more of the left-leaning. I mean, if you could call him left-leaning, he's a self-declared socialist. And he's really interesting to have. He's really likes respectful debates, and I really enjoy that. So obviously he was talking, referring to Trump and Cohen, which we'll get into later. But so the point is, according to Ezra Levant, this editor of a Canadian conservative organization, it appears, here's what he says about Trudeau, because it's not getting enough coverage in the media. For my American and British friends, Canada's Justin Trudeau is done. He might try to fight on. I personally think he's too damaged. He's irreparably damaged. Here's what happened. First, Trudeau was detonated today by his former attorney general, today being the 27th is when he tweeted this. He says Trudeau was detonated today by his former attorney general, Jody Wilson-Raybould, Canada's first Aboriginal attorney general. She testified in Parliament in meticulous detail how Trudeau and his staff tried to get her to drop criminal charges against a corrupt company that he liked. She refused to bend the law, but Trudeau and his friends didn't stop. Trudeau, his chief of staff, his principal secretary, even his finance minister, they met her 10 times, phoned her 10 more, trying to get the charges dropped. She wouldn't, so Trudeau fired her as attorney general. The story leaked earlier this month, but it was all anonymous sources. The former AG herself didn't say a word, saying she was bound by attorney-client privilege and cabinet confidences. She was effectively gagged, so Trudeau was the only one talking. Trudeau took advantage of her enforced silence to claim she supported him and everything was fine. After all, when he fired her as attorney general, he appointed her to the minor post of veterans minister. When she heard him make that boast, she quit as veterans minister, and according to sources, he was shocked. Interesting. Further development, because this has been developing for about a month now, according to this Ezra Levant guy. Then suddenly, Trudeau's right-hand man resigned, claiming he had done nothing wrong, which is odd. It looked like a compromise. His friend left, and so Wilson-Raybould met with the cabinet and the caucus again. Wilson-Raybould didn't say anything publicly. She hired a retired Supreme Court judge as her lawyer to advise her on what she should say. Under pressure, the Liberal-dominated parliamentary committee invited her to testify, and Trudeau grudgingly waived some privilege. So today being February 27th when he posted this, so today she testified in great detail exactly who pressured her, exactly how, exactly when, and she named names, including the Prime Minister himself. And then so it goes on to link to a statement and his own interpretation of the event. I like this because it's a really good rundown, I think, of everything regarding this Trudeau situation, because I hadn't even heard of this until a couple days ago. So it's interesting to see why all of this is in the news suddenly. And I guess it's just people figuring out that, whether in some cases it's that people are realizing that even though their leaders may be charismatic, they're not altogether trustworthy. In other cases, it's obviously a combination of that, as well as just all politics and trying to remove people because of political objections. So it's interesting to see that forming in today's world. Next, let's talk about Cohen. So, this is pretty controversial, but I mean, this is a libertarian podcast. How can we not talk about the guy who people from the right are saying, you know, he perjured himself, was convicted, and is going to jail for perjury, and then is coming back and testifying. And people on the left are saying, yes, but look at this and this. He supported his claims. Now, actually, Ted Cruz made a good point. Let me see if I can pull it up here. I don't want to get the quote wrong. But basically, he provided examples of how Cohen made false claims. And the president himself, if you saw his tweet, president tweeted earlier today a series of tweets regarding a manuscript that Cohen apparently had been writing and was sending to publishers that was sort of like a little autobiography kind of regarding his time in the White House. Because at this point, what now disgraced or fired member of the White House has not written a book, honestly. So anyhow, this was his draft book that he was writing. And according to the president and a few senators, they've read parts of this, and it seems to directly contradict what he testified in Congress this week. So, again, you know, what's the deal here? One, why are we having a convicted perjurer testify before Congress, one? And even if you justify that by saying, okay, we need his testimony, then now we have even more evidence showing that he is lying. And so it'll be interesting to see how this turns out for him, because if these allegations about the manuscript indeed are indeed true, then what's going to happen to Cohen? Is he going to be convicted on more counts of perjury? I mean, this seems like a pretty untrustworthy guy already, and now that these new allegations are coming to light, I'd say that Cohen is pretty dang corrupt and untrustworthy at this point. I mean, you know, if you look to the left, they're always talking this way about Trump. And, I mean, that's one thing, but if you're going to talk about how corrupt Trump is, you have to at least admit that there's a good chance that Cohen is just as corrupt, if not more so. Again, I'm not saying Trump is corrupt. I'm saying obviously he's had some shady dealings in the past. I don't think that affects him now or his decisions. I'm not going to get too much into that today. I just sort of want to focus on Cohen, because really, at this point, why is anyone trusting what this man says? So, finally, moving on to our next story, we're going to talk about Pakistan and India. What exactly has been going on there? Because this hasn't been really covered either, because, as usual, everyone's focusing on Cohen. And, of course, there was some coverage of the North Korea-Trump summit, but no one's focusing on Pakistan and India. I mean, this is, it's not a huge deal, but it's really weird. I mean, Pakistan and India basically threatened nuclear war against each other, and no one picked up this story. So, my source for this story is CNN. So, according to CNN, the reason for all this and the story behind it is that is the region of Kashmir. So, for those of you who don't know, and for those of you who aren't in geography and history geek like I am, Kashmir is basically this region of northern India that is contested by Pakistan, India, and sometimes China. All these countries claim this area called Kashmir, but none of them are actually really, very few of them actually take military action against this, because all three of them are claiming this area. They don't want to start a war or anything, so they're pretty much at an agreement at this point where they're just going to demilitarize the area, and all three nations are still claiming it, but no one's really enforcing those things. Except for, apparently, according to CNN, One thing we do, something that this whole the cataclysm for all of this happening between Pakistan and India is that an Indian pilot identified as Wing Commander, I'm probably going to butcher this, so forgive me, Abhinandan, was captured by Pakistan after his plane was shot down in a dogfight earlier this week between Pakistani and Indian warplanes over the ceasefire line in Kashmir. So, first of all, we have to pause here, because there's multiple things happening. Apparently, both Pakistan and both Pakistani and Indian fighters were breaking the agreement to demilitarize this area by flying fighter planes into Kashmir. And apparently they saw each other, since they were doing this at the same time, and started shooting at each other. One of them, an Indian plane, got shot down, as we just saw, and the pilot was captured by Pakistan. However, he was handed back Friday evening at a border post in the village of Wagha. While Indian-controlled Kashmir and Pakistani-controlled Kashmir are separated by a 435-mile de facto border known as the Line of Control, Wagha village sits on the international frontier to the south between the Pakistani city of Lahore and the Indian city of Amritsar. So, basically talking more about this. The border post has taken on a symbolic role in the decades-long conflict over Kashmir, despite being outside the disputed region, thanks to a daily military parade known as the Beating Retreat Ceremony. Every evening there for 60 years, Pakistan's Rangers and India's Border Security Force have taken part in a lowering of flags ceremony before sunset, typically around 4 p.m. local time. Military personnel in full regalia perform elaborate, fast-paced marches and high kicks in a show of one-upmanship. Then the soldiers lower and fold their flags of their respective countries and shake hands before flinging the border gates shut with a final flourish. It's a powerful show of pride which draws attendees from both sides of the border, as well as international tourists. So, apparently, the article goes on to say, this ceremony, which is done every evening, was cancelled by Pakistan until the return of their pilot, which just happened a couple hours ago, as I'm talking about this right now. So obviously, if you're listening to this after Friday, then it will have been Friday. That's why I said Friday. Anyhow, moving on. So that's interesting that such a little event, like one pilot being shot down, captured, almost caused nuclear war between Pakistan and India. I find it really interesting, personally, that Pakistan even has nuclear weapons, because I don't know about you, but this fact was unknown to me until today. So there you have it. That is the deal with Pakistan and India. Now, let's move on to our next segment, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Basically, this segment is going to talk about each week. I'm going to bring up a libertarian theme regarding liberty and rights and stuff like that, whether it's social rights. Today, it involves. Actually, you know what? I'm just going to play the intro and let that speak for itself before we really get into the topic today. All right, time for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, our libertarian theory segment, as I like to call it. So, today I'm going to talk about gun rights. What a great controversial topic to talk about. And again, when has this not been controversial for the past 10 years or so? So, my basic aim of talking about this today is just to throw out some facts. Because, I mean, let's face it. Very few people of the opposing political view are going to be listening to this. And I'm basically just preaching to the choir right now for the most part. But it's important that when confronted with arguments against gun rights, that we have the fact. And for those who are listening of differing political opinions and differing political views, I encourage you to keep listening for now, just because this is important. And even if you are still not convinced after this short segment, at least you'll have more information at your disposal. So, first talking about gun rights, the main argument against them in today's world are deaths. Of course, because why would that not be the main argument? If people die from guns, that is a terrible thing. So, according to a report released by the CDC, which, unfortunately, if you're listening live, there's no... Actually, you know what? Yeah, I'm going to link to the report right now if you're listening live in the stream chat. So look there in a second here. And if you're listening on the podcast, then the link to this, my sources for this will be in the description. So let's get into it. According to a CDC report, again, I'm sending the link in the chat. There we go. I just posted the, there's one, and where's the other one? There we go. There's two links, two sources I'll be citing for this. So first, let's talk about the CDC. The CDC released a report recently, a few months ago, actually, talking about gun violence. And according to this source, there are roughly 10,000 gun-related deaths a year, which is, again, a terrible thing. And I can definitely see why people who support gun control believe that it's needed. However, the fact is, most people in America don't have all the facts. So even though 10,000 gun-related deaths, and even though there are 10,000 gun-related deaths a year, according to this report by the CDC, 2 million plus crimes are stopped using guns. So that means that I'll be getting to this more, and I'll be fleshing this out further later. But basically, this means that, you know, there's more pros than cons for guns currently. I'll be looking at some more aspects in a second. But just looking at this one statement, just looking at these two facts alone, by removing guns, any kind of guns, we would be increasing crime and death rather than decreasing it. Because again, 10,000 gun-related deaths a year, 2 million plus crimes stopped using guns. And that's only, and then that 2 million plus number is only counting the crimes stopped when a shot was fired. It does not count the hundreds, possibly thousands of times that crimes are stopped using just by someone having a gun visible on them or holding a gun in a threatening way. And next, the another major argument, which I can also see the other side's point of view on this one. Another major argument is that, no, it's not just deaths, it's school shootings. Children die. And I agree. Children dying is a terrible thing. I would never say that that's a good thing. Obviously, I'm not a terrible psychopath. But they say children die from this. This is not good. Tons of children die. This needs to be stopped. However, only 10 out of the 10,000 gun-related deaths a year are children. And I'm not saying, again, this is tricky water because, I mean, people are still dying. But the point being here is that currently it's worth it to have guns, and it will always be worth it to have guns, and rather than no guns at all, or even less guns. And guns protect people. So according to a story by USA Today, in print and on TV, Americans are bombarded with facts and figures suggesting that the problem of school shootings is out of control. We are informed, for example, that since 2013, there has been an average of one school shooting a week in the U.S. and 18 since the beginning of this year. This article was written a bit ago, but it still stands. While these statistics were not exactly lies or fake news, they involved stretching the definition of a school shooting well beyond the limits of most people's imagination. So, for instance, when someone says school shooting, image that comes to mind is a crazy psychopath marches in with an AK-47 and starts shooting up the entire place, killing multiple children. However, according to this article, it says, Every Town for Gun Safety reported that there have been 290 school shootings since the catastrophic massacre in Newtown, Connecticut more than 5 years ago. However, very few of these were anything akin to Sandy Hook or Parkland. Sure, they all involved a school of some type, including technical schools and colleges, as well as a firearm, but the outcomes were hardly similar. Nearly half of the 290 were completed or attempted suicides. Accidental discharges of a gun, or shootings with not a single individual being injured. Again, nearly half of the 290 were completed or attempted suicides, accidental discharges of a gun, or shootings with not a single individual being injured. Of the remainder, the vast majority involved either one fatality or none at all. It's easy to believe that school shootings are the new normal, as has been intimated, or that we are facing a crisis of epidemic proportions. When schools are placed on lockdown based on an active shooter alert, which many times is a false alarm, cable news channels immediately inform their viewers of the danger, and word is tweeted and retweeted to millions, most of whom have no direct connection to the event. And when gunshots ring out, we hear the sounds replayed from cell phone recordings and watch through satellite feed as terrified survivors flee the scene. It makes a lasting impression, to be sure. For all those who believe that schools are under siege like never before, it is instructive to take a statistical road trip back in time. Since 1990, there have been 22 shootings at elementary and secondary schools in which two or more people were killed, not counting those perpetrators who committed suicide. Whereas five of these incidents have occurred over the past 5-plus years since 2013, claiming the lives of 27 victims, the latter half of the 1990s witnessed 7 multiple fatality shootings with a total of 33 killed. In fact, the 1997-98 school year was so awful, with 4 multiple fatality shootings praised at the hands of armed students, that then-President Clinton formed a White House expert committee to advise him. Nearly a decade later, President Bush convened a White House conference on school safety in the wake of multiple fatality incidents during his administration. Of course, I don't mean to minimize any of the one per week on average school shootings, but they should not be conflated with the most deadly but rare events. So, the end takeaway from here is, on the subject of school shootings, that actual school shootings, which are not suicides, and which people actually die, are extremely rare. And while those are still terrible and should not be minimized, it is not worth removing all of our guns, or some guns, and thus causing many more thousands of people to die per year than it just to try and prevent those shootings. And of course, I don't have time to go through all the facts and figures on today's show. If I were to go through everything, I would take months. But there's plenty of evidence out there to support the claim that taking away guns would in fact increase deaths, not decrease them. And it would, in fact, increase crime, not decrease it. Again, I'll be putting my I put my sources in the live stream chat, and I will put the sources in the podcast description after this is published. So, next for our gun rights discussion, let's look to the to Australia, because if you need any more information, all you got to do is look at Australia. Australia, since banning guns altogether about 5 years ago. Anyhow, since Australia has banned guns altogether, since Australia has banned guns altogether, the number of guns in Australia actually has gone up. So let's look at that again. Australia banned guns, flat out, banned them. Not even policemen have them now. And the number of guns in Australia went up. That means, yes, that just because you make a law doesn't mean criminals are going to follow that law. So again, I understand the concerns of our leftist counterparts here. But the fact of the matter is, making a law does not mean that everyone will follow it. Criminals do not follow laws. By definition, a criminal is someone who breaks the law. So, thus, if you ban guns, only criminals will have guns, because only criminals are the ones who break the law. And let's face it, criminals aren't the ones who do school shootings. They're the ones who kill people. They're the ones who mug people. They're the ones who steal cars, break into people's homes, and terrorize people. So really, at the end of the day, since we have factual evidence from across the world, done by, as well as evidence done by the CDC in regards to school shootings, the fact of the matter is, banning guns or reducing gun liberties is not the thing to do to decrease gun violence, gun crime, and gun-related deaths. I'll end this with hunting is not the real reason for the Second Amendment, because, again, most of our leftist counterparts, when they talk about banning guns, they're like, well, you know, okay, yeah, hunting's fun and all, but is hunting really worth all these people dying? And disregarding anything else I've said so far, it's important to realize that while many people use hunting as an excuse, it's not the reason we have the Second Amendment. We do not have the Second Amendment so you can hunt. And I've been hunting. It's great. Hunting can be fun. It cannot be fun, depending on what you like. But the point being, hunting is not the real reason we have the Second Amendment. As Thomas Jefferson said, a little revolution is a good thing now and then. I'm not advocating for revolution at this point. But again, the first step that any totalitarian regime takes and has taken or will take throughout history is to remove the right to keep and bear arms. That is why that right was written explicitly into our Constitution, because our founding fathers knew, should we lose the right to firearms, we would lose all of our other rights. Again, I'm not trying to fearmonger here. I'm not saying that our leftist counterparts want to take away our guns so they can take away all our other rights. I'm just saying that anti-gun policies have very good intentions. They have the best of intentions, sure, but they don't work in real life, and in addition, they pave the way for authoritarianism. Now, let's move on to our economics corner. A little thing I'm going to do each week that is, talking about a libertarian view of the economy and defending the free market economy, which is really important. So let's move in to our economics corner. Isn't that sound effect great? I'm so happy. This is the best produced show on Earth, let's face it. So, moving on. Our economics corner today talks about the Green New Deal, because let's face it, it's not just an environmental policy, it's an economic policy. In fact, it's a massive set of economic policies, plural. Now let me get a drink of water before I go into this, because this is going to be interesting. All right, so first thing I want to talk about with the Green New Deal is we have to see that before we move on to the Green New Deal, like, man, it's a good thing that we have this first broadcast to really work out the kinks, isn't it? Let's first go into our, let's take a brief break with a word from our sponsors before we continue. I'll be right back, I promise. All right. So, first I want to talk to you about Flipboard. Flipboard is a with so much content whizzing around out there, there's only one storytelling platform that helps you keep calm, stay informed, and inspired. Flipboard. Flipboard curates the world's stories so you can be smarter in your work, life, and play. Choose from thousands of topics to personalize Flipboard and get the latest stories from the best publishers and experts delivered to you 24/7. When you see stories that you want to save or share, tap the plus button to add them to private or public collections. It's that simple. Used by millions of people every day, Flipboard is how people move themselves and the world forward. Have you ever thought about starting your own podcast? When I was trying to get this podcast off the ground and all the other podcasts involved with the bipartisan media platform, I had a lot of questions. How do I record an episode? How do I get my show into all the apps that people like to listen? How do I make money for my podcast? And that's the most important question of all, of course. The answer to every one of these is really simple. Anchor. Anchor is a one-stop shop for recording, hosting, and distributing your podcast. Best of all, it's 100% free and ridiculously easy to use. And now Anchor can match you with great sponsors who want to advertise on your podcast. That means that you can get paid podcast right away. In fact, that's what I'm doing right now by reading this ad. So if you've always wanted to start a podcast and make money doing it, go to anchor.fm/start. That's anchor.fm/start to join me and the diverse community of podcasters already using Anchor. That's anchor.fm/start. I can't wait to hear your podcast. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Jonesing for Liberty. I'm Rod Jones, the host, of course. And let's get back into our program where I left off talking about the Green New Deal. So, first thing that we have to realize, if you're not listening and you're on the left, So if you're not on the left, the first thing you need to realize is that the left is very serious about the Green New Deal. I know personally because I know a lot of them. And it's really interesting to see how involved they are into the Green New Deal. So before I continue further into this discussion, I want to address some things. Evidently, we've been having some technical difficulties with the stream. Just getting some comments, and it doesn't seem to... Oh, there we go. Okay, we're live again. Good. Just wanted to make sure. Anyhow, so all the listeners who are listening live, real quick, if you could do me a big favor, comment if you heard the last music I played to rejoin, because we might be having some technical difficulties with that. I don't think our rejoins are working altogether well, but I'll fix that in the next episode for sure. So please comment if it's working or if it's not. I really need to know. All right. Moving on. Back to the Green New Deal. So, of course, before we really get down to the nitty-gritty of what the Green New Deal is, there's a party split that has sort of occurred in the Democrat Party because of this. You have, because I'll talk about in a second, it's basically at least half the policies are veiled socialism. And so you have part of the Democratic Party who says, no, you know, we don't want this, we don't want this, we don't want the Democratic Party to go in this direction. And those more moderate Democrats are being called out by the more left-leaning Democrats, the more radical Democrats, such as AOC herself, who first proposed the Green New Deal in conjunction with a few other Congress people, calling out, you know, we see that they're calling out other Democrats who don't support this and some of her other policies regarding the more radical side of the Democratic Party. But moving on to the economics of it, as I said before, the Green New Deal is basically veiled socialism. I mean, there are so many things in the Green New Deal that are literal socialist policies that also have nothing to do with the environment. It's crazy. I mean, you have proposals for universal healthcare in there. You have not just universal healthcare, universal single payer healthcare. You have a universal minimum wage, a standard minimum wage. Not just minimum wage, but like a Basically, it's a new type of welfare for people who aren't working, who are on welfare. They'll earn a certain minimum wage just by being there. And so I can go on and on and on about why and how I disagree with these policies, but the point is they have nothing to do with the environment. So why on earth are they in the Green New Deal? The Green New Deal, the whole point of it, and we heard about it before it was unveiled, the whole point of the Green New Deal was to turn our environment around and reduce pollution and all that. And I'll talk about that in a second. But so the bottom line here being, the point of the Green New Deal was originally supposed to be to fix the environment, right? And now they're throwing in all these socialist policies. So we can debate the Green New Deal. That's one thing. But the socialist policies need to be removed if we're even going to consider the Green New Deal. And now I'll kind of move on to the other reasons I think that the Green New Deal is not worth our time. So basically, let's move on to the economic impacts, because the Green New Deal, even without the socialist policies, is a bad group of policies. It's one of the things it does, for instance, is of course the now famous talk about eliminating all fossil fuels within a decade. And on top of that, they aim to end all uranium power within a decade. So not only would we have to, of course, end air travel and among other things, and as well as remove our uranium power as well. Now, I'm looking at some to make sure I don't get it wrong. But basically what we have here is that I had a bit of a connection issue there. Where was I? Right. So let's get back to the Green New Deal. The Green New Deal is marketed as a set of programs that will fix climate change. There are three reasons why I think we should not support it at all. One, fear-mongering. The proponents of the Green New Deal are proposing way larger changes than are actually needed. Climate change is a thing, and it is important to cut down on man-made climate change. However, man is changing climate less than the proponents of the GND claim. In the end, the severe economic ramifications of the GND are not worth the benefits that they may or may not, that the Green New Deal may or may not bring. Socialism. Hidden within the Green New Deal are many socialist economic policies that have literally nothing to do with the environment. We need small changes to our behavior in regard to the environment, not socialism. 3. Unfeasible. The many drastic changes proposed by the proponents of the Green New Deal are not only unnecessary and bad economically, many are completely unfeasible. One example is cutting out all fossil fuels in 10 years. This is literally impossible. And in addition, any attempt to enforce it, even partially, will lead us regressing to an Amish paradise, devoid of industry and relying on an agriculture-based economy. Only around 10% of energy in the U.S. is currently provided by renewable sources, and that's counting nuclear energy, which the Green New Deal seeks to cut out as well. That percent needs to increase, but it needs to do so on its own and at a slow and steady pace through the free market. America just isn't ready for the Green New Deal, and it probably never will be. So there you go. There's my spiel on the Green New Deal. Before we move on to our last segment, again, the bottom line here is the Green New Deal causes more problems than it fixes. And in addition to it being unfeasible, as I said, there's this fear-mongering going on the part of the proponents, and of course socialism, which most libertarian listeners here probably completely disagree with, because, that's a whole nother topic. Moving on to our libertarian update. Let's go. Isn't that the best music? I mean, really, I definitely could not have found better production pieces and better music for this program. So our libertarian update today is Howard Schultz a libertarian? So according to a piece by Stephen Nelson in the Washington Examiner, former Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz may be able to avoid a 50-state scramble for presidential ballot access by seeking the Libertarian Party's support. Members of the large national third party, which took more than 3% of the vote in 2016, are intrigued by Schultz and might be willing to give him the party nomination in 2020, meaning he would not have to gather hundreds of thousands of signatures as an independent. Mr. Schultz describes himself as a fiscally conservative and socially liberal, so I kindly encourage Mr. Schultz to look at our platform, as that title goes hand in hand with what the Libertarian Party stands for, end quote, said Florida Libertarian Party Chairman Marcos Morales. The idea of Schultz running as a libertarian was discussed over the weekend in Southern California, where that state's Libertarian Party Executive Committee gathered in Long Beach for a meeting, followed by a fundraiser. California Libertarian Party Chairwoman Mimi Robson said there was interest in learning more about Schultz's positions. Quote, he's definitely a fiscal conservative, and he also appears to be generally for civil liberties and individual rights. So those things are all in line with the Libertarian Party, she said. There's kind of a wait-and-see attitude. It's one of those things like, oh, it's an interesting idea, but there are other people who may run as libertarians. So basically, this article from the Washington Examiner, obviously, will Howard Schultz run as a libertarian? And if he does, will he get the nomination from the Libertarian Party? I know for a fact, from just a brief perusal of Twitter, that there are many other people that people want to, that citizens and members of the Libertarian Party and community want to see nominated into the Libertarian Party. And I don't think any of them mentioned Howard Schultz. However, it will be interesting to see what his real political views are, because if he is indeed fiscally conservative and socially liberal, which is, of course, the main politically speaking, the platform of the Libertarian Party, it'll be interesting to see how well he does, considering he probably has a lot more wealth than plenty of the libertarians who will be running for the nomination in 2020. But that's just your libertarian update, Howard Schultz, possible libertarian, but also probably an imposter who really just doesn't want to run as an independent if he does run for president in 2020. So that's a wrap. That's the show for today. This has been Jonesing for Liberty with Rod Jones. I'm your host, Rod Jones. Don't forget, follow me on Twitter. At Darodster, that's at DARODSTER, at DARODSTER. I'm very active on there. I'm sure you'll enjoy the stuff I put out, as well as I like to sort of collect news from across the libertarian spectrum and conservative spectrum and tweet it out and spread it around. So yeah, and of course, I welcome engagement from anyone who is listening to this. Tweet at me at Darodster, email us at bipartisanpodcast@gmail.com. Again, that's bipartisanpodcast@gmail.com. And our bipartisan media website is sites.google.com/view/BP Media. That's sites.google.com/view/BP Media. Our normal domain is supposed to be bipartisanmedia.com. But that's we've been having some technical difficulties with that ever since we tried to launch it. So we're trying to fix that. But in the meantime, science.google.com/view/BP Media. So once again, thank you so much, everyone who's listening. And we'll come back next week. We'll talk about current events again. Under our Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness section, we'll be talking about more interesting libertarian theory. And, of course, in the economics corner, it's I'm deciding between minimum wage and simply talking about free market trade. So, until then, I'll see you around. Don't forget to email or message me on Twitter. Don't forget to check out the Bipartisan Media Twitter page, also curated by myself. For updates on all of our shows. at Bipartisan Media is the simple tag. And if you go to our website, we have a shop there. It's outdated, but we are updating it currently. So check that out. Support us any way you can. Again, thank you. And I'll see you another time. If I can get this, we can get this going, that is. I'll see you another time. There we go. All right. See you around.